asked me to fill in his class, and I'm not qualified to fill in this class that Elton has begun here. And he talked to me about what he would like for me to do, and so I listened to it and I ignored it. And so I'm going to do what I want to do here. And so I'm going to back away, okay, from the details a lot. And I want to talk in more generic terms, because I know what it's like to get fed lots of information. You're sitting here trying to assimilate that information, and you're asking yourself, why am I trying to remember this? What does this mean to me? I don't understand what value I get out of this. And so I want to back away from the particular topic a little bit and try to help us get a perspective of the value of manuscripts and studying manuscript evidence, and relate that to, and I want you to relate it in your mind to the question, can I trust my Bible? Because that's really what we're talking about. That's why this is important. Is the Bible reliable? And I want to make a note, too, that this study does not address evidence of inspiration, whether or not the Bible is from God. That's not what this study is. And we sometimes, in the middle of the study, we tend to bleed over from one to the other, and that's not what this study is. That's a completely different study. It's very worthwhile, but we're not, when we talk about this manuscript evidence, we're talking about evidence of the accuracy of the Bible, not whether or not it came from God. But how can I know that what I'm looking at and what I'm reading here, how can I have any confidence that this is what was originally written? That's what this study is about. That's what manuscript evidence is about. So keep that in mind, first of all. And I know that a study of canonicity, and that's just a big religious word, and it's not exclusively religious, but we don't use it in many other circles. Canonicity means this is the process of determining how each one of these books was included in the Bible. And it came to be called the canon. And it's not the thing that you shoot, but the canon is this complete book. How there were certain tests that each book had to pass in order to be incorporated into this book. There were other books that people wanted to be considered to be put in the Bible that didn't pass the test. Now, that's another study. How do you determine, how was canonicity determined? Well, how was it determined that a book was inspired, it was actually written by the person that it said it was written by, that it has the value of the other books and so forth? And I realize this. There are a few people, relatively, who are really interested in this. There are a lot more people who are not. And we kind of like, it distresses some people to study canonicity. I mean, it bothers your mind. Because we kind of like to believe that one day God wrote this book and he bound it in red leather and he handed it down to somebody. And we've got it. That's how we got it. And most folks, and I'm being a little bit facetious here, maybe a lot facetious, but most folks kind of are content to believe that this, you know, God inspired this book, this is the way how we got it, and so forth. My point is, I don't want to create any doubt where there is no doubt. What's the purpose of that, okay? And so don't let this distress your mind as you talk about manuscript evidence and canonicity and why this book made the cut and this one didn't. Don't let that bother your mind. And I think there's some really general principles that the world would scoff at, but if God is God and God did inspire a book, and I believe God's capable of working things out so that we have that book that he wanted us to have. And so if that satisfies you, and it pretty much satisfies me, by the way, even having studied some of this other stuff, I'm still pretty satisfied with that. I believe that if this is God's way of salvation and he didn't provide that for us, then it's going to all end up being his fault. So Some of them are. Well, one of them would be the difference between a Catholic Bible and a Protestant Bible. That would be one of them. Okay? That's correct. In most cases, it's really obvious. You'll have like 1st and 2nd Maccabees that are included in the, quote, Catholic Bible that are not in our Bible that are good history. They're really, really good history. In fact, we use them, you know, for history books. Okay, speak as loud as you can.
There's a commercial that's coming out now from the Catholics where they're saying that they actually have broken the Bible. I mean,
preserved it.
I saw it yesterday. Is there a comment to that?
Yeah, I do have a comment. Did you hear his comment he made? He said there is a commercial that he saw yesterday that's coming out from the Catholic Church. It says that they're the ones responsible for preserving the Bible. Well, in a very convoluted way, there is some truth in that. But the real truth is that during the Dark Ages, while there were a few copies that they preserved, they went to great, great lengths to keep people from getting them. And so I'll just leave that as it were. That's correct. So here we are back again, and this is what I knew. This is good, okay, because we're talking about things, practical things, about we're not the manuscript yet, but actually it has to do with them. Let me give an example of why I think it's important for this study. At least for those who are involved in studying with other people. There's a part of me that wants to say ignorance is bliss. There are some things I don't want to have to know. Are you that way? I mean, there are some things that the more you know about it, the less you like it, or, you know, familiarity breeds contempt kind of concept. And there are some things in this life that you can afford to be ignorant of, but there are some things that you can't really afford to be ignorant of. And there are some things that you need to know a lot of, and there are some things you know a little of. So I'm going to leave it up to you to determine where any or all of this falls in your particular situation. But let me give you a practical illustration of why I think it's important that we at least think about these things and have some reasonable response to people who have that question. Currently, Janice and I are involved in a long-term study with a couple here. They were here, by the way, in the assembly last week for the very first time after about 6 months of our studying with them. And I know that some of you got to meet them and so forth. But she grew up in USSR. It's one of those Stan countries. I think it's Kazakhstan or, you know, Uzbekistan or whatever is Stan, you know. There's a bunch of new ones now since USSR broke up into Consortium of Independent States, CIS countries. But she grew up in a communist USSR, totally unfamiliar with the Bible, weren't allowed to have copies of the Bible. Came here, beautiful story of how she got here. It wasn't so beautiful. It's beautiful from my perspective, but incredibly difficult from her perspective. But she came over here by herself with about, I think, $40 in her pocket with no job and no relatives and no nothing. And it's been an incredible journey that she has had in her life. But she's totally unfamiliar with the Bible. But as she grew up as a child in what we would consider remote and really cold country, et cetera, minus the influence of the Bible as much as the government could accomplish that, then her grandmother believed in God. And that was a dangerous thing. She would go to school and she would be taught against the Bible and taught why anybody that believed in God was foolish and so forth. But her sister had a teacher who, when he began to teach that in the upper grade school levels, he would apologize to the students and say, "I have to teach this. I'm sorry." And then he would teach godlessness, that there was no God. When they got home, their grandmother would tell them, "This is not true. There is a God." And she would talk to them about God. Now, that's what they knew about God, what their grandmother told them. And it was pretty homespun, but yet their grandmother deep and abiding faith in God, and it was unshaken by all of the things that happened in communism and all of that. And so she grew up with one of the people that she most respected in her life believed in God, and then everybody else basically didn't. And so that's where she came. And then she married a guy that was a God believer, pretty important in his life, at least at this point in his life when they met and got married. And so as we sit down, Janice and I, we meet up in the library in another building over there once a week, and we study for a couple of hours, and been doing that for 5 or 6 months, I don't know how long. And we've been going really slowly, and there's a reason why. She asks hard questions, okay? She had an insistence that our first study be along the lines of, how can I know that this Bible is real? Now, you want that study? You know, most of us backpedal from a study like that because we believe it is. We just don't know why we believe and not able to step up and prove that it is or give evidence that it is. And this past week, she asked this question. Can I know that every word in this Bible is the same as when it was originally written? Now, what would you say? Well, how would you answer that? Can I know that every word in this Bible is the same as it was when it was originally written? Now, part of me wanted to say, yes, you can know that. And she would have accepted me saying that. But in all honesty, I can't say that. And see, when we start talking about here, then folks inside start quivering just a little bit. What would you say to somebody who asked that question? Well, there's lots of things you can say. But what I chose to say was, I can't honestly say yes to your question until we talk about some things. And let's talk about this, and I use this illustration. She has a 5-year-old child. That child speaks English. Her native language is Russian. She's in the process of learning to speak English, and she's probably 80-85% there. Speaks English plenty well enough to communicate. Runs across some words sometimes, and she'll stop you and say, okay, what does that word mean? So that's a good thing. So I said, you have some writings that you grew up with in Russia that you would like for your son to be familiar with. But they have never been translated into English. And they only have been written in Russian. But they're important to you. They're an important part of your life. And you want him to hear those. And so in order for him to hear those, you sit down and you translate that document, whatever it is, maybe a poem, maybe whatever it is, you translate that into English. Now, I have a question for you. You've got the Russian document here. You have the English document here. I come to you and I ask you, is this word for word this? What are you going to say to me? And she said, well, no. Sometimes in order to get the meaning, you have to add some words. I said, thank you. That's exactly my answer to you. And I said, there are some Russian words that you have to use, a single word that you might have to use 5 words to accurately convey the meaning of that one Russian word. And so when you ask me, is this exactly the same word for word as that? That's my answer to you. That's one of the things that has to be taken into consideration. It's when you translate from one language into another language, and by the way, neither your New Testament nor your Old Testament was written in English originally. It was written in other languages. And so that had to be translated. So is it the same? Well, I can say yes, or I can say you ask me a real specific question, so I'm going to give you a real specific answer. And so does that mean that I can't have the confidence? There's other things that come into play here. And one of the reasons I use the New International, it's not because I think it's the most accurate. It's just because I grew up with the King James Version, and at some point in my life as I was teaching others, and particularly when I went overseas, I didn't want to have to try to explain the begetteth and the, you know, me thinketh and the King's English. I mean, you're just adding lots of difficulty to it. And so I went to a more modern translation. This is supposed to be third grade English, and so that kind of fit where I was. I didn't find any real problems, maybe one or two, and I've noted those along the way, but then every translation has a problem or two, I think. And so I use the New International. Now, 1984 New International, they're fixing to quit printing it, so they're really messing me up. I've had to change from King James to New International once in my life, and now, if I don't die before too long, I might have to change again, you know, because they're not going to print the 1984, and they're going to print a 2011 and quit printing this one that I have here. And I don't know, because they want to make money, I guess. But, I'd like to choke somebody. They want to leave it alone as long as I'm alive, and then they do what they want to after that. But one of the weaknesses of the NIV and some others, this is a little bit more of a thought translation than literal, word for word. Consequently, there are no italicized words in the New International Version translation. Why do translators put italicized words in the text? That's right. For the very reason that we mentioned a few moments ago. In order to smooth a meaning out, sometimes you have to add some words in order to make it understandable in another language. When King James translators, and I think American Standard, maybe Revised Standard, whenever they translated it and they had to add some words, they italicized those words so that you would know when you read it, that word right there was not in the original text. It was added in order to smooth the meaning out. The New International Version translators didn't do that. And I find that, I'm sorry they didn't, because I like to know which words actually were in the text and which ones weren't. Anyway, this is some stuff about translation, all right? Manuscripts are important about translation. Let's talk about manuscripts. What is a manuscript? And I was not here at Elton's first class, was not able to be here, so I'm probably repeating some things, but a manuscript is an original or a hand-created document. That's what a manuscript is. Today, we say it could be typed, because that's one way that we call it hand-created. You know, it doesn't have to be penned today. It could be typed because we got typewriters and computers and so forth. So a manuscript is an original or a hand-created document. Bible manuscripts, when we talk about Bible manuscripts, they didn't have typewriters back then. They didn't have computers. And so they're what? They're handwritten, and they're handwritten on some pretty frail stuff. For instance, how long do you expect a pair of shoes to last? 20 years? Hey, I'm not laughing at that. I got some that's 20 years old. Somebody, this older guy said to this kid one time, asked him how old he was, and he said he was, whatever, 18 years old. He said, boy, I got socks older than that. You know? But let's stretch it out. 100-year-old pair of shoes is pretty old, right? 200-year-old pair of shoes, really old. Do you know anybody that's got shoes that are any shoes, even if they put them up somewhere, that's over 200 years old? That's pretty old. But they have a way of disappearing, don't they? Why? They deteriorate, right? Why? They're written on something that's not eternal. It decays. And even if there's writing on it, then what happens to that writing on that material as it decays? You get to where you can't read it, right? Now, how about a 1,000-year-old pair of shoes? How about a 2,000-year-old pair of shoes? What do they look like? And what would any writing that had been done on the inside of those shoes look like? A Okay, you got the point that I'm making here? This was written, the very fact that we have any manuscripts is pretty incredible, really. It has to have been preserved in a really special way. For one thing, it couldn't be preserved in the swamps of Louisiana or down here in South Texas either. Why? Because the humidity deteriorates and it rots fast, doesn't it? So only in places of extremely dry climate could something be in any way outside, even if it were inside a cave and exposed to temperature changes and so forth, and survive in any way. I mean, at some point, leather just turns back to dirt, right? It just dissolves, deteriorates to that point. So we're talking, and papyrus is even more frail than that. What was papyrus? Yeah, that was plants that got flattened out and pressed together and writ on, right? And so that didn't last too long either. This is pretty frail stuff. So the very fact that we have any manuscripts is pretty incredible, that are thousands, that we can honestly say are thousands of years old. That's pretty incredible. It's incredible there's anything written on them that we could understand. So let's start out with that, okay? And not be so critical. Do we have the originals? No, we don't have the originals. Do we have the originals of Shakespeare's work? No. Why aren't we all distressed about that? Why don't we question the validity of that, like we do the Bible? Because the manuscripts that have been preserved from the Bible are much, much, much older than manuscripts that would have had to do with anything within the 16th century or thereabouts. So right here is a good place, and I'm not going to get through one-fourth of the material I've got. It's a good place to talk about this information that you're in the process of studying right now with Elton, the Codex Washingtonensis, or Codex W, or Freer Gospels, or Washington Codex. Those are all words that are applied to that particular codex. What is a codex, by the way? It's a manuscript in book form. That's what a codex is. And so this Washingtonensis was discovered in 1906 in the excavated ruins of an Egyptian city that is believed by some to have, the city believed to have been abandoned in 200 A.D. Now, it was sold, it was discovered in 1906. Now, when it was discovered has nothing to do with how old it is, right? It could have been discovered today. There are still things that are being discovered today. Then you have to go back and see how old they were. So the 1906 only tells us this is when we became aware of their existence. It was sold to Charles Freer, thus the name given by some, the Freer Gospels, who housed it in the Smithsonian Institute in Washington. Scholars originally dated these manuscripts in the late 4th and early 5th centuries. That's when they believe. Now, when I say late 4th century, what? Give me a number there. Yeah, 390s. Okay? That's when they originally. And if you want to Google it, you can put Codex W in, and you can get lots of sugar for a dime. Okay? You can get lots and lots of information here. probably a lot more than you might want. But in 2002, an Oklahoma Christian minister wrote a book entitled 2002 Codex W, Old and Holy. He has since revised it and changed the title to First Century Gospels Found. And this guy is the basis of much of the information that you're looking at right now. The premise of this book is that scholars have misdated these manuscripts. And that is based on the belief that where they were found, the city in Egypt where they were found, was completely abandoned in the 200s. And so anything that was found in that city having been buried, the premise is that it was there when the city was abandoned in the 200s. Are you still with me? Okay? Now, is that a legitimate assumption or not? Could people go back into the ruins of an old and hide something, yes, they could, you know. But that's the premise, that if it was found there, discovered there, then there is a premise that it was there whenever the city was abandoned. And he specifically believes that he has cracked certain, quote, codes in these manuscripts that he believes gives evidence that they were first copies, not the originals, but first copies of the Gospels penned by people who knew the writers, by their contemporaries. And that the original authors, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, read that and put a stamp on it saying it was valid. That's what you're studying right now. And the end of the class, this last time, he touched on a little circle that you find at the bottom of each one of them that is believed by some, at least, to be the apostle's stamp of approval on their particular gospel account. And then you're going to study about the bird with the wiggly tail and on each one of the documents as a means of dating that particular document. And so Brother Elton's going to present this evidence to you, and you can judge for yourself. My observation personally is that from my perspective, whether this document proves to be a first century document or from the fifth century, it is, in fact, some solid evidence of the Gospels, the validity of the Gospels as we have them today. I don't know if it goes back to the first century or if it is a fifth century document, personally. But anyway, that's what you're studying right now. What exactly, what does this type, this manuscript type of evidence prove? Now, just in general, what does it prove? Well, if we can find manuscript copies of the Bible that date closely to the time that they were originally penned, what value is that? Now, you stop and think. You don't have to be any kind of a paleontologist or anything to reason through this. What would be the value of finding a copy of a document 100 years after it was written? What would be the value of that? You tell me. Okay, accuracy, what do you mean by accuracy? Okay, if you could, first of all, you got to be able to date whatever you found, right, with some accuracy. And then you, if you can translate, if it's written in something that you can read, you lay it down and you translate it as literally as you can, and then you compare it with what you've got, and you have an accuracy comparison, right? Another thing that it does, you know, almost without us thinking about the value of it, if you can date it at, let's say, 200 A.D. after death of Jesus, then what does that say? It says that that document existed before 200. Right? You with me? That's one of the values of finding manuscripts, that you can go back and with some accuracy you can date that manuscript. Because if you can find one, or even a piece of one, you don't usually find whole documents. You usually find pieces. Sometimes they're little bitty pieces. But if you can find one that you can with accuracy know that it dated such and such a time, then you know, okay, that document existed prior to that time. That's valuable. Because critics today will make all kind of claims that the Gospels were written hundreds and hundreds of years after the fact. And this was all manufactured, it was all mythology and so forth. Well, if you can go back and say, well, I know this, by 200, it was in existence. That's a pretty valuable thing to be able to say. If you can go back to 100 and say, with the same accuracy that you could any other historical document say, it was here in 100, that's even more valuable, isn't it? You're getting pretty close back there, aren't you? And so, this is what Elton is trying to demonstrate to you, and his belief is that this Codex W, these Freer Gospels, existed before 100, which would have put them contemporary with at least some of the people who originally wrote it. So keep that in mind as you study with Elfin here. Now, so manuscript evidence has value in that it proves that it was in existence at the time that you can date that manuscript, and it also gives you a basis for comparing the accuracy of what we have today. If you can translate that and it says in the beginning was a word and the word was God and so forth, and you can go back to Genesis 1 in your Bible and it says that same thing, then would that give you some confidence? Sure it would. Sure it would. So that's the value of manuscripts. Now, I want to have a little bit of discussion. We could go for three classes on this, but so I'll cut it off if you get too verbose here. But the discussion between what proves something and what doesn't prove something. We throw that word around, and I throw the word around sometimes, and I try to be a little more careful. What proves something to one person doesn't necessarily prove it to another person. We're in a little bit of a philosophical discussion here, but let's not let it deteriorate into just purely philosophical. This is a practical thing also. Someone presents evidence, and you and I listen to that evidence. And when that evidence has been presented, I jump up and say, okay, now I know, and I tell you what I know. And you say, I'm not so sure. So that evidence that was presented, did it prove the point or did it not? Your job's not to prove. You hear me? Your job is to present evidence. Whether or not it proves it is not up to the person who presented it. He may declare this proves so-and-so. He may shout it and scream it and so forth, but it may not prove it to me, and it may not prove it to you. And if you'll read the Bulletin article today, I've tried to address that a little bit. There are different reasons for different people why they won't accept certain things. Sometimes you have an agenda for their not wanting to, for you wanting to believe there's no God. And so it doesn't matter how much evidence is presented. If you don't want to believe there's a God, nobody can prove it to you there's a God. There's not enough evidence in the world. The Jews asked for a sign. And when they got a sign, they kept asking for another sign. When they got another sign, they kept asking for another sign. What's the point? There's not enough signs. And Jesus said, there's not going to be any more signs given to you except one. Sign of the prophet Jonah. Just as Jonah was in the belly of a big fish for 3 days and nights, so the Son of Man will be in the grave 3 days and nights. And then what's going to happen? He's going to pop back up. And that's going to be the last evidence you're going to ever get. And if that's not enough to prove it to you, that's your problem. All right? Let's take just a moment and the illustration, and I haven't even got started. A court trial. What is the responsibility of the prosecuting attorney in a court trial? How does he do that? Prove beyond a shadow of doubt what the accused, that he's guilty, right? How does he do that? Presents evidence, okay? There's some evidence that's better than others, right? There's some evidence that's admissible and some that's not admissible. There's some that's pertinent and there's some that's not pertinent. But his job is to present enough valid evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the accused committed the crime for which he's accused. Now, what's the defense attorney's role? Okay, how does he create doubt? How does he get him off the hook? That's it. To demonstrate that the evidence that has been presented is either invalid, irrelevant, inaccurate, or inconclusive. That's his job. And if he can do any one of those, then there's a shadow of a doubt. And the guy gets off. Well, manuscripts are witnesses. They're evidence. We don't have to overstate what they prove, but we can't accept what they do prove. And as Christians, in this matter as well as other matters, let's be real, okay? The true folks, you don't have to truth is perfectly capable of standing on its own legs. Now, you have to educate yourself enough to know what evidence there is, and it certainly is beneficial if you can present it in a way that is convincing. But the truth, you don't have to carry the truth around. It's not crippled. The truth is the truth, and it's going to be the truth regardless of what the jury decides. And the jury is you. There are people that there's been a multiplicity of evidence that has been presented that there is a God, and they say what? No God. What if you presented twice that much evidence? Would they say, yeah, there's a God? Well, maybe some of them, maybe. Okay, I'm not just in blanket indictment everybody who says there's not a God has this ulterior motive that can't be overcome, but some do. Some do. And if it's your job, if you feel like it's your job to prove this to somebody and make them say there is a God, then you might waste your life. You might cast your pearls before hogs for the rest of your life. Now, that sounds pretty rough, doesn't it? I didn't say that. Somebody else said that, didn't they? And so you're going to have to decide when, you know, give it your best shot, educate yourself. This thing of manuscript evidence is a powerful, powerful argument for people who will listen and who will have an interest in it. Somebody got a question. I got too much to try to say. They wouldn't believe. That's right. Let me make this statement ending up here. And until this last decade, it was believed that the oldest manuscripts dated to 120 A.D. 120 A.D. is pretty close back there, right? But now there are three manuscripts that it is widely believed that are earlier than that. And if the Codex W proves to be earlier than 120, then that's going to be number four. But the jury, as far as I'm concerned, is still out, and you're the jury on that. But these three are believed to be dated before A.D. 70. And if you can go back before A.D. 70, you've got some eyewitnesses that are alive at that time, if that's true. And so there are 24,000 manuscripts in part or whole, mostly in part, that predate 600 A.D., 24,000 pieces that have been found that predate 600. So that would be in the 500s. That's lots and lots of evidence. Lots of evidence. Incredible amount. More by far than any other work of antiquity that is in existence. So I'm sorry I didn't get time to present that in a little more detail, but maybe we'll save that for another day if you're interested. So thank you for your interest. Thank Elton for giving me this opportunity to do this, and I'm sorry that I didn't get around to more of it. Enjoyed it. Thank you. God bless you.